Mr. President, from a purely formal point of view, this meeting arises from a complaint brought against the government of Israel. However, let me make it quite clear that sitting here as the representative of the government of Israel, as I have the honor to do, I am in no way sitting in the dock as the accused party. On the contrary, I stand here as an accuser on behalf of free and decent people in this world. I stand here as an accuser against the forces of evil which have unleashed a wave of piracy and terrorism which threatens the very foundations of human society. I stand here as an accuser of all those evil forces which in their inherent cowardice and abject craven attitude see blameless wayfarers and innocent women and children, yes, even babes in arms, a legitimate target for their evil intentions. I stand here as an accuser of the countries that, because of evil design or lack of moral backbone, have collaborated with these bloodthirsty terrorists. I stand here as an accuser of all those in authority throughout the world who, for reasons of cynical expediency, have collaborated with terrorism. I stand here as an accuser, sir, of this world organization, the United Nations, which has been unable, because of the machinations of the Arab delegates and their supporters, to coordinate effective measures in order to combat the evil of world terrorism. I stand here as an accuser of those delegations to this organization, which for reasons of political expediency have remained silent on this issue, an issue which is bound to affect every country in this organization. In so doing, they have become themselves accomplices. Seated in the dock today, with the accusing finger of enlightened world opinion directed against them, are the terrorist organizations which are plaguing this world, and whose representatives have in the past been seated here by the world body with rights equal to those of member states. In the dock are all those countries who have collaborated with the terrorists and who have aided and abetted them. There stand here accused those countries which have blocked every international move to deal with this plague of terror which besets the world. In the dock before us stand all those countries, they are all too numerous, who cry to the high heavens when they are affected by terrorists, who fulminate at this Security Council table when their citizens or diplomats are threatened, and who remain silent when the same happens to citizens of other countries. Some of them don't even have the doubtful grace to remain silent. They have the wicked effrontery to join in a condemnation of a country which tries to prevent these acts, In the dock before us stand the representatives of all those countries. The President of Sudan personally gave the order to execute the American and Belgian diplomats bound hand and foot in the basement of the Saudi Arabian embassy in Khartoum on the 1st of March, 1973. Yes, sir. Before us stands accused this rotten, corrupt, brutal, cynical, bloodthirsty monster of international terrorism and all those who support it in one way or the other, whether by commission or omission. Facing them today are the ordinary, decent human beings throughout the world who seek nothing more than to live a life free from terror and from intimidation, free from the threats of hijackers, the indiscriminate bombs of terrorists, and the blackmail of criminals and murderers. Israel's action at Entebbe, in order to release its hostages, has given rise to a worldwide wave of support and approval, such as has rarely been seen, from every continent, including Africa, from every walk of life, from countries hostile as well as friendly to Israel. The ordinary man in the street and woman in the street has risen behind us and proclaimed enough to this specter of terror, has cried out enough to this world body of pontificating diplomats in which on so many occasions moral cowardice and cynical expediency have combined to drag it down to the depths to which it has plunged. Mr. President, in more ways than one, this organization is in the accused stand today. Mankind will judge it by its behavior on this occasion, because never has the issue been clearer. Never has the issue been so clear-cut. There will be no excuse in history for this body or for the constituent members of this body if it fails to condemn terrorism. The issue before this body is not what Israel did at Entebbe Airport. The issue before this body is its own future in the eyes of history. Mr. President, the representative of Uganda has very conveniently avoided the main issue before us. Let me recount the events as they occurred. On Sunday, the 27th of June, 1976, an Air France Airbus flight number 139, en route from Tel Aviv to Paris, was hijacked by a group of PLO terrorists with 256 innocent passengers aboard, in addition to a crew of 12. The terrorists took advantage of the lax security measures obtaining at Athens Airport and brought on board pistols and approximately 20 grenades. Thus began a methodically planned and carefully executed act of air piracy by the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, one of the several terrorist groups joined together to form the PLO. Thus began another in a long list of PLO crimes against innocent civilians. Having commandeered the aircraft, the hijackers forced the French pilot to land in what is by now internationally accepted as the first haven for such criminals, namely Libya. This is the country which has for years acted as paymaster of international terror movements, Arab and non-Arab, throughout the world. It is, I submit, sir, a disgrace to this world organization that the representative of this world sponsor of terrorism is seated as a member of the Security Council, the purpose of which is to encourage the maintenance of international peace and security. To return to our story, the Air France plane was refueled in Benghazi. The destination of the hijackers was, in accordance with a previously prepared plan, Entebbe Airport, outside Kampala, in Uganda. The Airbus landed at Entebbe Airport on Monday, the 28th of June, and the hijackers were met by a reinforcement of terrorists who awaited them at the terminal, armed to the teeth with submachine guns and explosives. President Idi Amin of Uganda arrived at the airport shortly before the hijacked plane landed and embraced the hijackers in a gesture of welcome and a promise of support and assistance. Ugandan soldiers were then positioned with their guns trained not on the hijackers, but at the innocent civilians, men, women, and children. On Tuesday, the 29th of June, 1976, the hijackers spelled out their demands. These included the release of 53 terrorists jailed in Israel, West Germany, France, Switzerland, and Kenya by a deadline of 3 p.m. local time, Thursday, 30th of June. They threatened to put the innocent passengers to death if their terms were not met. When the hijackers released 47 women and children and some passengers on Wednesday, the 30th of June, it gradually became apparent that President Amin was in fact cooperating with the terrorists under a cloak of deception and false pretense. This was the situation on the evening of July the 1st, the first deadline set by the terrorists. It became obvious that the Israeli passengers, men, women, and children, were in serious and grave danger for their lives. When the hijackers released a further 100 hostages, their story, when they arrived in Paris, revealed an ominous development. They described to the waiting reporters how Ugandan soldiers, under direct orders of President Amin, supervised the separation of Jewish passengers from non-Jewish passengers. Mr. President, this was a development of a nature so sinister and so pregnant with memories of the past that no member of the Jewish people, whether in Israel or abroad, could fail to recall its horrible significance. There flashed immediately upon the inward eye of every member of our people the memory of the terrifying selections carried out during the most horrifying Holocaust that man has ever seen, which beset our people. We recall the selections carried out by the Nazis in the concentration camps as members of the Jewish people were singled out for the gas chambers and extermination. Mr. President, following the never-to-be-forgotten experience of the Holocaust in Europe during World War II, an oath was taken, whether consciously or unconsciously, by every member of the Jewish people, wherever he or she may be, that never again would this happen, that never again would circumstances be allowed to develop in which such a can develop, 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 could happen, and would never again return. On this occasion, Mr. President, I solemnly reaffirm before this body the oath which has been taken by our Jewish people, wherever they may be, it will never happen again. And so, when this ominous reminiscent selection began, when the separation of the Jews was undertaken, it became apparent to the government of Israel that there was no alternative but to conduct a rescue operation to save the lives of its citizens. The government of Israel's apprehension was heightened by a knowledge of President Amin's attitude to the Jewish people. In September 1972, President Amin sent a cable, which was published on the 13th of September 1972, to the Secretary General of the United Nations, Dr. Kurt Waldheim, with copies to the Prime Minister of Israel and to the leader of the PLO, Yasser Arafat. In this cable, President Amin applauded the murder of the Israeli sportsman at the Olympic Games in Munich, who, bound hand and foot, were gunned down by the PLO. Moreover, in the same message, he had the obscene gaulishness to praise Hitler for his role in destroying over 6 million Jews. Distinguished members of the Council will recall that but 9 months ago, President Amin in the General Assembly of the United Nations called for the extinction of Israel as a state. Mr. President, the combination of the move to separate Israeli and Jewish passengers from other passengers, the official endorsement of Hitler's policies by the President of Uganda, his call for the extinction of Israel, and the horrible fate of hundreds of thousands of his own countrymen who did not find favor in his eyes. In this connection, I refer you, sir, to the terrifying recital of the brutalities of what it refers to as the dictatorial fascist ruler of Uganda, published on the 7th of July by the government of Kenya. All these combined together to bring home to the government of Israel the realization that unless action were taken, the hostages, men, women, and children, were doomed and could expect no mercy in Entebbe. At this point, Mr. President, let me quote from the statement of Prime Minister Rabin to the Knesset on the 4th of July, and I quote, The time of expiry of the ultimatum drew increasingly closer. The release of non-Israeli passengers more and more exposed the evil conspiracy against Israeli citizens. The political efforts bore no fruit. The sand in the hourglass was about to run out, leaving no possibility for any independent rescue effort. Under these conditions, the government of Israel decided unanimously to take the only way left to rescue our people and declared its readiness to release terrorists detained in Israeli prisons with the terrorists. We were prepared to adopt even this alternative in default of any other to rescue our people. This was not a tactic to gain time, and had this choice alone been left, we would have stood by our decision as a last resort." Unquote. The hijackers raised their demands. They announced that Israel would be held responsible for all the terrorists whose release they demanded, including those terrorists not held in Israel. And they refused to allow the exchange to be made in France or on neutral territory outside Uganda. Their sinister tone and new demands boded evil for the hostages. The government of Israel was left with no alternative. On the night of the 3rd and 4th of July 1976, the Israel Defense Forces mounted a most remarkable operation which will go down in history, rescued the hostages, and escorted them to safety. I wish to reiterate on this occasion, Mr. President, that Israel accepted full and sole responsibility for the action, that no other government was at any stage party to the planning or the execution of the operation. The operation was planned and executed by Israel. We are proud of it. During that rescue operation, three of the hostages were killed by the terrorists before they were gunned down by the Israeli troops. A senior Israeli officer was killed, shot in the back, and several soldiers and hostages were wounded. Mr. President, the weight of evidence before us reveals prior knowledge and active connivance on the part of the government of Uganda in this whole episode. Even if the evidence were not available, and I say it is available in abundance, it is sufficient to read the letter addressed by President Amin to you, sir, on the 4th of July, 1976, in order to reveal that he implicates himself in his own statement. It is quite evident from his letter that the Ugandan troops mounted guard not over the terrorists and the hijackers, but over the hostages. In the fifth paragraph of his letter, he states, I quote, "I directed that the plane be guarded properly," unquote. He then goes on to make the most incredible statement, and I quote, "The Ugandan armed forces were not allowed by the hijackers to go near the airport building," unquote. This is known to be false. The Ugandan troops were in and around the building. He then reveals his complicity in relating the story of the release of the 147 hostages on the 30th of June and the 1st of July by openly admitting his part in separating the Israeli passengers from the other passengers. Mr. President, one does not really require all this evidence in order to prove that Israel was entirely justified by every norm of natural and international law to take the action which it took. In viewing the facts of the case, one must reach one of two conclusions. Either the government of Uganda was directly implicated in holding as hostages innocent passengers, men, women, and children, or the government of Uganda does not exercise sovereignty over its territory and was incapable of dealing with half a dozen terrorists. And what better evidence do we have to support this contention of ours than the fact that to date the government of Uganda has not released a 75-year-old lady, Mrs. Dora Bloch, who was on her way to the marriage of her son in this country when the plane was hijacked. Moreover, the refusal of the government of Uganda to release the Air France plane immediately after the hijackers were eliminated only tends to confirm the fact of complicity. What other reason should there be for the government of Uganda to refuse to return the plane to the French government in violation of the Hague Convention of 1970, to which Uganda is a signatory? If the government of Uganda is not implicated in this crime, why was a 75-year-old lady, Mrs. Bloch, not released immediately after the hijackers were eliminated? Why was she held in custody under guard in hospital in Kampala? Why was she not released to the British consul when he called on her on Sunday, July the 4th, after the rescue operation? Why have we suddenly been notified ominously that the Ugandan authorities, four of whose employees reportedly dragged her screaming from the hospital, are unaware of her whereabouts? Either the government of Uganda exercised national sovereignty, in which case it knows where she is, or it doesn't. I asked my colleagues, Africans and others here, who were joined to condemn Israel for exercising its inherent right of self-defense, do you or do you not condone the horrifying behavior which is reflected in this act of chivalry on the part of President Amin against Mrs. Dora Bloch, age 75? For once, have the courage of your convictions and speak out, or be damned by your own silence. Mr. President, here you have a plain, simple case which has no answer and cannot have any answer for decent people wherever they may be. Here you have the unbelievable, macabre spectacle of a state waging a war against a 75-year-old lady, supported presumably by those who would associate themselves with this despicable and cowardly behavior. If the government of Uganda is not implicated, let it now and forthwith produce Mrs. Bloch. Mr. President, does this council propose to remain silent on the fate of Mrs. Bloch? The disappearance of this old lady and the by now all too familiar picture of the terrifying happenings in Amin's Uganda provide ample justification in themselves for the premonition which prompted the action taken by the government of Israel. Mr. President, this type of action, which in principle is not unprecedented, is dealt with at considerable length in international law. And there is no doubt whatsoever but that the weight of international law and precedent lies fully in Israel's favor. However, the Israeli action at Entebbe came to remind us, Mr. President, that the law we find in statute books is not the only law of mankind. There is also a moral law, and by all that is moral on this earth, Israel had the right to do what it did. Indeed, it had also the duty to do so. Mr. President, what mattered to the government of Israel, in this instance, was the lives of the hostages in danger for their very lives. No consideration other than this humanitarian consideration motivated the government of Israel. Mr. President, Israel's rescue operation was not directed against Uganda. Israeli forces were not attacking Uganda, and certainly not Africa. They were rescuing their nationals from a band of terrorists and kidnappers who were being aided and abetted by the Ugandan authorities. The means used were the minimum necessary to fulfill that purpose, as is laid down in international law. Mr. President, summing up the daring and imaginative operation which we are discussing, my Prime Minister stated in the Knesset on the 4th of July that, and I quote, "This rescue operation is an achievement of great importance in the struggle against terrorism. It is Israel's contribution to humanity's struggle against international terror, but it should not be viewed as the final chapter. It will give us encouragement as we continue our efforts. But the struggle is not over. New efforts, new methods, and unremitting sophistication will be required. Terrorism will find us neither immobilized nor hidebound by routine." Unquote. In many ways, This is a moment of truth for this organization. If the Council will fail to seize this opportunity, which has been granted it, to eliminate the scourge of terrorists, kidnappers, hijackers, and blackmailers from our midst, then it will plunge to the lowest depths in the eyes of mankind and will disappear in history as yet another great and tragic lost opportunity in history. It has fallen to the lot of my small country, embattled as we are, facing the problems which we do, to demonstrate to the world that there is an alternative to surrender to terrorism and blackmail. It has fallen to our lot to prove to the world that this scourge of international terror can be dealt with. It is now for the nations of the world, regardless of political differences which may divide them, to unite against this common enemy, which recognizes no authority, knows no borders, respects no sovereignty, ignores all basic human decencies, and places no limits on bestial humanity. We come with a simple message to the Council. We are proud of what we have done because we have demonstrated to the world that in a small country, in Israel's circumstances, with which the distinguished members of this Council are by now all too familiar, the dignity of man, human life, and human freedom constitute the highest values. We are proud not only because we have saved the lives of over 100 innocent people, men, women, and children, but because of the significance of our act for the cause of human freedom. We call on this body to declare war on international terror, to outlaw it and eradicate it wherever it may be. We call on this body, and above all, we call on the member states and countries of the world to unite in a common effort to place these criminals outside the pale of human society, and with them to place any country which cooperates in any way in their nefarious activities. In calling this body to action, Mr. President, I cannot ignore its limitations, which are daily demonstrated by the fact that this body, this Council, has sat silent through 15 months of the greatest tragedy besetting the world today in the Lebanon, while a nation is torn apart, tens of thousands are killed, tens of thousands more are wounded, and the cup of human suffering overflows daily. Let me remind you that when the hijacking took place, this Security Council was debating the report of the so-called Palestine Committee. The Security Council held 4 meetings on the Palestinian question while an act of terror carried out by Palestinian terrorists was taking place, yet this Council did not even see fit to raise the question and plead for the release of the innocent civilians. If this body fails to take action, we call on all freedom-loving countries in the world to come together outside the framework of this body, establish accepted norms of behavior in relation to terrorists, and declare in no uncertain terms that each and every one of them will have nothing whatsoever to do with any country which violates these norms and which encourages terrorism. Once hijackers have no country in which to land their planes because receiving such a plane would mean exclusion from the world community or part of the world community, whether in the field of air transportation, trade, commerce, or international relations, there will be no more hijacking. We are proud to have given the lead in this struggle against international terrorism. This debate is an opportunity for the world to take action on this issue, which can affect the lives of every man and woman and child in the world. Those countries which fail to take a clear and unequivocal stand on this issue for reasons of expediency or cowardice will stand damned by all the decent people in the world and despised in history. There is a time, Mr. President, in the affairs of man when even governments must make difficult decisions guided not by considerations of expediency but by considerations of morality. Israel was guided by these considerations in risking much to save its citizens. May we hope, Mr. President, that others will be guided by these principles too. Thank you, Mr. President.